Hi, friends. So it's actually my birthday here in a couple days, so really you all being here is your gift to me. Now, if you remember the last time that I was up here, we were looking at Psalm 121, and Psalm 121 verses 1 in particular and a little bit of verse 2 as well. But today I want to go a little bit further and look at verses 2 and 3, and I actually kind of hope to have already done this back in July before I messed up my own schedule, so sorry I'm late on this one. But why don't we go ahead and read the psalm actually all the way through, verses 1 through 8, and then we will get started. This is Psalm 121. Psalm 121. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. From where will my help come? My help is from Yahweh, maker of heaven and earth. He will not allow your foot to be moved. He who protects you will not slumber. Look, he will not slumber, he will not sleep. He who protects Israel, Yahweh is your protector. Yahweh is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. Yahweh will protect you from all evil. He will protect your life. Yahweh will protect your going out and your coming in from now until forever. Now, if you recall from last time, we said that we can kind of come to a psalm like this and immediately beautiful scenic images come to mind, like I lift my eyes up to the mountains. And it kind of just sounds like this is just a happy psalm reflecting on all the wonderful things in life. But friends, if we just take a moment to step back and consider what is going on here. There are a lot of things in this psalm that don't make a whole lot of sense if the mood is just happy. Right? I mean, there in just verse 3, he will not allow your foot to slip is only comfort to somebody who feels like they are already stumbling through life, to somebody who's already familiar with uncertainty and instability. The promise that your guardian will not slumber is only reassuring to somebody who's been in a place of wondering, where are you, God? Don't you see what's happening to me? And don't get me wrong, yes, there is totally times when we find ourselves in moments when life is pretty good, and we can and we should be grateful that we've been protected from things that would cause us distress. But what I want to put forth to you today is that this psalm is for people who are in distress, who know exactly what it's like to be there. And what's interesting about this psalm is just how well it reflects so much of the inner conflict that we can sometimes feel in the Christian life. Faith and hope in Jesus Christ, uncertainty as to why he would allow me to go through what I'm going through. Knowing that God is in control of what is to come, questioning how there's any bigger picture reality behind the suffering I'm in now. You see right there at the beginning of the psalm begins with these four words, a song of ascents. And that note there is actually part of the original writings, and Psalm 121 is one of 15 of these songs of ascents. Those are Psalms 120 through 134. And what this four-word phrase indicates is we're reading one of the songs that the people in ancient Israel would sing as they were gathering from all across the world to meet in Jerusalem and ascend up the mountain where the temple was located. And the temple, of course, this place is just extraordinary. Just imagine everything that you might think of when you imagine heaven. Do you think of a place of rejoicing? Do you think of it being beautifully decorated? Do you think of a place of feasting and gratitude? Do you think of a place where everyone is taken care of and has what they need? Because the temple was like that. Gold everywhere, people singing, dancing for joy, a massive treasury dedicated to helping out those who were in need and collecting funds to take care of everybody. The temple was purposefully designed to be on earth as it is in heaven. And so kind of the idea here is that as you ascended to the Temple Mountain, you were ascending to where God is. As you were getting closer and closer to the temple, you were drawing near to the God of heaven, to the source of all goodness and beauty. And again, with all of this in mind about the temple and just the kind of images that we tend to perhaps think of, let's say, like when a friend comes back from a backpacking trip or a vacation somewhere in the Rockies and tells us what the mountains are like. Perhaps we come to verse 1, I lift my eyes up to the mountains, and perhaps we think of a beautiful, majestic landscape with awe-inspiring peaks and valleys, like, wow, like I got to get a picture of this kind of thing. And this could not be further from how these poor travelers making their way to Jerusalem thought about the mountains. And already you start to see that inner conflict of joy, gladness awaiting us, but also difficulty and hurt in our immediate present. Because much to the contrary of how we might tend to think of the mountains, these specific mountains that these poor travelers had to navigate were known to be a place where gangs of robbers and looters and thugs would hide out. That they were even filled with dangerous animals. Everywhere you turned, you had to keep your guard up. And in fact, these mountains in the hill country are likely the setting that Jesus is referring to when he tells the story of the Good Samaritan. He says, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. So you can kind of imagine this man is probably actually, instead of going up, he's leaving some festival at the Jerusalem temple probably. And now instead of ascending, he's going back down on his way home. But this is the road that he's traveling. And when he was attacked by robbers, they stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. So in a sense, this story of the Good Samaritan is all too relatable to Jesus' listeners because people knew the kind of dangers that the mountains would bring. The mountains represent uncertainty, doubt, having to fend for yourself, being left alone in the dark, all of these troubling human experiences. The mountains were the place that you looked when you were afraid and you had no idea what was coming. And now I lift my eyes up to the mountains. It's suddenly starting to sound a lot like as I look at that report from the doctor, as I look at the results of this upcoming election, as I search for that thing to fix the ache in my heart. You might even feel this on behalf of somebody else. As I look at my child who is struggling to make friends, or at least good friends, at school. Notice how quickly the psalm has gotten very personal. And notice that this life sustained by God, this psalm has to offer, is not one that tells you to just stick your head in the sand and deny what's going on around us and the fear that might be up ahead. The people who have been through the mountains are no stranger to anguish and distress in their lives. And it was in these moments of anguish, of distress, that the people of God for thousands of years of faithful promise-keeping came to the boast of verse 2, my help comes from the Lord, maker of heaven and earth. And as I was kind of thinking about the richness of verse 2 and how confident this psalm is in assuring us that the Lord is our help, I was reminded of how so many things that we hear in life, we don't need to know the full story to know what's going on, right? For so many of the things that we hear, we don't need to know every single detail of how things are going to work out to make sense. Let me give you an example of what I mean. This one is for the parents. When I send out a text that there's going to be a GPS tonight, and just to be clear, there is not going to be a GPS tonight, but when I send out a text that there's going to be a GPS tonight after youth group, you would never stop me to ask, but you're not going to make my kid walk to the pot getters after church, right? Right? Like you just kind of fill in the context. Like, yeah, my kid is going to get a ride to GPS. Or here's another example. If you know me at all, and I came to you sometime in the next couple months, and I said, you know, last night I had the most delicious venison of my whole life, you would immediately think, Logan must know somebody. He must be friends with somebody who hunts because there's no way that Logan went out and shot himself a deer. Right? And so much of life is like that. So many of our interactions with each other where there's that kind of unspoken context that we know. We don't need to give each other every single detail when we communicate. And we kind of expect the person hearing us to fill in that information. And it's a lot easier to fill in that information the better that we know each other. But similarly, in the Bible, it's often the case that there is so much unspoken context that we're kind of expected to fill in order to grasp what's being said. And so when we get to verse 2 here, we are met with one of the most impossible important things that you can find in the entire Bible, where there is so much unspoken context that we cannot afford to forget. Right there in verse 2, the answer to the question of where does my help come from is the word the Lord, in all caps, but it's so much more than that. You see it right there in your Bible, and many of you already know this, but any time that you see the Lord written in all capital letters, the Bible is signaling to us that God's proper name, Yahweh, Jehovah, is being used. And there is so much tied up in just that one name that these people who were first singing this song were consciously calling to the forefront of their minds that we often forget. That there's so much unspoken context in the proper name of God that these people were filling in that we often forget. And so this is, think about it this way, just to kind of illustrate. It's kind of a common thing for us to approach people differently depending on maybe what position that they might hold. And so imagine this, perhaps you or somebody that you know is really into history, right? And let's say maybe it's U.S. history in particular. And let's say that this person that you know is kind of the type where they could list off the names of every single president who served as president of the United States and could list all of their accomplishments and shortcomings. Let's say that you or this person are that invested in American history. And now I'm not calling anybody old or anything. I mean, it's not like when I go to the movies, my parents get the senior discount. But some of you would have been alive when someone like Ronald Reagan, who passed away in 2004, was president. And now imagine if somehow, some way before Reagan had passed, you were awarded a special luncheon. You were awarded a special luncheon invite to the White House to go sit down one-on-one with Ronald Reagan. Now, some of you might think, I don't even need to know anything about American history or the other presidents. I'd take that in a heartbeat. But now think of all the unspoken context that would come into play in that appointment with President Ronald Reagan. You would know that this scenario is a little bit different than, say, if I invited you out to lunch, right? And you would be able to fill in the unspoken context that President Ronald Reagan's invitation takes precedent over your schedule. Like, I'm willing to bet if you received an invite like this, you probably wouldn't write back to the White House and say, well, you know, November 17 at 1 o'clock is a Sunday and my Detroit Lions are playing the Jaguars, so could the president reschedule around this Lions watch party that I have on Sunday, November 17th? No, I'm willing to bet that you would know that your schedule bends to the president's and not the other way around. And if all of this unspoken information would readily come to the forefront of your mind when dealing with the president, how important do you think the significance of the name Yahweh is? You see it right there in verse 2, already attached to the name Yahweh is that he is the maker of heaven and earth, that creation itself, the fact that there is a world to begin with, is the basis of God's goodness being shown to us, the stage on which his goodness unfolds, the canvas of his love for us, that waterfalls and naps and puppies and friendship and cinnamon rolls and sunsets are not accidents, but the context in which Yahweh invites us to experience him in. And if he can sustain all of that, if he can sustain the cosmos, if Yahweh can sustain the gravity on planet Earth so that we don't go flying off into space, if he can handle all of that, I think he can sustain Robinson Baptist Church. If he can feed and provide for all the animals on planet Earth, I think he can feed and provide for Robinson Baptist Church. I and we do not need to provide. It's Yahweh who creates, sustains, and blesses. But what this means as we look at God's sustaining care and how Yahweh meets us in the midst of difficulty and suffering of life, the most important idea of Psalm 21 is not, hear me, is not us being helped. This is the beginning of the unspoken context that all of these people got when they came to the name Yahweh. They knew that God is not a means to an end to get more of what we want. They know that this is not someone we are approaching or who we're dealing with. We can negotiate or boss around for more of what we want when we want it. If you think dealing with the president demands that you come with reverence and respect, that is nothing in comparison to what these people came before Yahweh with. which means that suffering and discomfort is not a time to treat God like he's some kind of cosmic vending machine. Like, A5, I'll take 2 packs of encouragement, please. Or D3, a less stressful work environment would be nice. You just kind of punch in what you want and come to him, and once you receive, you go your merry way. Like, let's just kind of camp out here for a second in the reminder that we all need all too often that the complete wrong way to go about instability, suffering, and fear is to come to God as a means to an end to get more peace, more calm, more stability. Yahweh is not a means to an end. Yahweh and knowing Yahweh is the end. And instead, when we suffer, when we experience instability, we are met with an opportunity to recalibrate our lives around what is most true, what is most significant, and what is most desirable, Yahweh. And now, unfortunately, we can spend the rest of our lives kind of studying and pondering this name, Yahweh, and not even scratch the surface of how profound it is. So this little sermon is nowhere near enough to do justice to what we're talking about here. There's only 45 minutes left. This is a joke. The name Yahweh appears 6,828 times, each time adding depth and significance to what this name has meant across time throughout generations. So you better believe that this is an important idea. And it's such a big idea because virtually everything that there is to know about God and all that the Bible communicates about God is wrapped up in this one name. The mind-blowing, transcendent, greater-than-we-can-fathom realities about God and the nearness and gentleness and generosity and attentive care to the details of our life, all contained in the name Yahweh. With the name Yahweh, God is not somebody that you can speak about in a detached sort of way, but just as the name of someone that you love would cause you to think about all the memories and the feelings that you have toward that person, that is what the name Yahweh should lead our hearts and minds into. You see, for these people singing Psalm 121, as they first prepared and oriented themselves toward approaching God, they heard from the earliest days what we read in the book of Genesis, that Yahweh is working to counter the effects of our own brokenness, that he did not leave us in what we deserved after choosing our own selfish ways instead of the things of goodness and truth. And they heard that Yahweh had attentively chosen his people to redeem them and the whole world out of the mess that we humans so often contribute to. And even when these people found themselves in the hands of ruthless slave drivers in Egypt, they heard of Yahweh who raised up a deliverer, because Yahweh doesn't abandon his people. And he demanded that this deliverer, Moses, go into the house of the most powerful man on earth and tell him to let my people go because they're mine, not his, not the world's or anyone else's. And so there Moses is. He's kind of speaking to God, shaking in his boots because he has no confidence in who he is. But he says to God, okay, but I'm going to need a name. And so God responds in verse 14 of Exodus 3. And this is actually where we find the story of God giving his proper name to his people for the first time. And he tells Moses, I am that I am. To which I kind of always imagine Moses being, sure, because that pretty much clears everything up. But that's the name, Yahweh, the God of your ancestors. I am that I am. And this is not at all as obscure as it may sound. What God is actually saying is that reality itself, being itself, life itself is sourced in me. Everything good and lovely and desirable flows from me. Everything, every breath. I am that I am, Yahweh. And what is happening here with God's name is that he is showing himself to be infinitely great, but intimately near, beyond our comprehension, and more mercifully near and attentive than we could fathom. And this is not just a name to skim over. This is not just some job title like officer or senator or CEO. This name, Yahweh, is God getting down in the face of his people and telling us that he is present rather than distracted, disinterested, or forgetful while he manages the big things in life that we think actually matter and are more important to him than our needs. We also see him saying that he is powerful, that he is not on the same level as the other things that we run to when we are in trouble. And notice that it's on this basis of Yahweh's power that everything that is flows from him, that the psalm shifts into verse 3. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. And watch that shift in perspective. I love this shift from verse 2, where it's kind of like that confident boast in Yahweh that my help comes from the Lord, to verse 3, where now the speaker is no longer just kind of talking about his own newfound confidence in Yahweh, but kind of seems to shift his attention to the other people around him, right? It's that my help comes from Yahweh in verse 2. And now in verse 3, hey, friend, look at this. He will not let your foot be moved. He who watches over you will not slumber. But then, of course, there's this element in which verse 3 can almost start to sound like too good to be true, right? It can almost kind of sound like one of those cliches that Christians will throw around all the time when they're thriving, but then when you're actually in the thick of something, it's not that helpful, right? It almost sounds like a promise that God can't really deliver on, right? That the Christian life will be this one that is just completely uninterrupted and without turbulence and disruption. And that is not at all what this verse is saying. Verse 3 is not saying that you will never feel unstable. When it says that he will not let your foot be moved, it is saying that though you tremble, though you struggle, though you stumble, though you trip, you will never fall beyond the reach of his care. That you will experience instability, that you will encounter the dangers of life, but you will never decisively fall off to a place that God cannot and will not seek you out to restore you from. So as beautiful as a promise as verse 3 is, I just want to go ahead and call attention to that reality that much of the Christian life, much of the with God life, much of the life in the keeping care of God does feel unstable. And so kind of like if we come to church wondering like, do you even know the week that I had? And you look around with all the chaos that's been going on in your life and everybody else is smiling and having a good time and you're kind of asking like, why am I the one who gets the instability? Let me just remind you that anyone who is doing this life right has something and is struggling one way or another. Everyone has a cross to bear, so to speak. I assure you that you are not the only one, and much of life with God feels like you were just learning to ice skate. My coaches in college, they would always say, you know, that if you play the game the way you practice, if you want to play well, you just practice hard. But the problem is that with life, we don't really get a test run to do it over again, right? Like much of the weighty things in life, we don't have time to practice for or to figure things out before they come. And every person who has ever lived a life with God has found themselves kind of in a partnership where they're way out of their league, where he's carrying all of the weight. Much of the Christian life feels like 2 steps forward, 1.9 steps back. Much of the Christian life feels like, where am I going? 3 steps forward, 4 steps to the left. And the promise of verse 3 is not that uncertainty and missteps and miscalculations and tripping over your own 2 feet will never come, but that all of it can and must take place within the guardrails of Yahweh's keeping care over us. And that within the safety and the reliability and the instruction of God's guardrails, there is room for everyone, no matter how much stumbling they have done. And so as we've already seen from the beginning of verse 1, the assumption of the Christian life, the reality that comes with walking in goodness that all of us have to reckon with, is that we do have to first lift our eyes and walked through the difficulty awaiting us in the mountains. But he, praise be to God, will not let your foot be moved. He who watches over you will not slumber. That not even for a second will he fall asleep at the wheel. That one hits a little close to home. That joke's a slow burn. Some of you will get it out in the parking lot. He doesn't fall asleep even for a second. Not even for a second does he start daydreaming or get distracted. That not even for a second will he drift off from responsibly watching over us. And so the question is that when we are looking to ensure the care of our souls is where do we turn and run when the way forward in our present circumstances are called into question? Because if you show me the place or the person that we go to first, I can show you where your confidence really lies. Is it your own competence, your own ability to figure things out? Is it the people that you know or the person who's just a call away or someone who could bail you out if needed? Is it that place of comfort that we often seem to go to distract us from the chaos that's going on outside? Oftentimes, we know the right answer and the answer that we should give, right? That correct answer that every one of us might expect to give in a Sunday school class, right? Like, of course my confidence is in Yahweh. I'm a believer. But oftentimes, what is the right and good Christian answer that we know we should give hides from us what is functionally true for us, what is actually true for our lives, where we can easily be hasty and trick ourselves into believing that the right answer is true for us when in reality we're running to something else when we are under pressure. So hear me, that the worry and the anxiety and the distress that comes our way is an opportunity for us to evaluate where we are actually getting our help from and what areas of life God can reveal his faithfulness to us anew. That suffering and instability will always test us and show us where our foundation is solid versus what areas of our life we are dependent on some other person, some other institution, our own personal giftings. And that is a blessing because those other things are not built to carry the weight of life and neither are we. And so even if you have a great job, even if you have the approval of people in your life, even if your body is healthy right now, know that none of those things are enough to keep you. Right? That apart from Yahweh, there is guaranteed instability, no matter if you have all those ducks in a row or not. But with Yahweh, even as you walk through the valley of the shadow of death, he will preserve, sustain, bless, protect, and keep the essence of your being. Now, if you recall last time, I exhorted us that we do not have to live in verse 1, right? This is the fretfulness of looking up at the danger that lies up ahead of us. There is so much more for you, Christ follower, than the fretfulness of looking up at the mountains and just meditating on the doom and gloom that is up ahead. How is this need going to be met? How is it going to be addressed? How is it going to be taken care of? And to invite you forward into verse 2 to the boast of where our help comes from. But kind of in a similar way, let me encourage you not to blow past verse 2 into verse 3 and the rest of the psalm, but to meditate upon and to fill in the unspoken context of who Yahweh is. Let me exhort you that the meditations of your mind and the thoughts that you think on repeat set the course for what you will feel and believe about everything. That the things that you fix your mind on will greatly determine the narratives that your soul will be fed in the silence of the night. Yahweh was not a detour before we talk about peace and the good stuff at the end. Yahweh is the end. Do not pursue God because of a current situation. Pursue God to get God and let him work out the details as he pleases on his timetable. Let us pray. Father, I thank you for your goodness to us and your keeping care over us, that you watch over us. Lord, I thank you for what confidence we have that when we come to the boast in who you are, that the maker of heaven and earth is the one that is for us, that the power of life itself, the one who's put breath in our lungs, is not finished with us yet, Lord. That not even for a second are you disinterested in us. Not even for a second do you turn away to check out something else. Not even for a second are you forgetful of us, that you hear us, that you know what is best for us, and that you are eagerly waiting to show yourself and your goodness to us and to draw us into deeper relationship and dependence on you. And dependence on you is the best thing because you are the one thing that will not disappoint, that will always keep your promises, that will always keep up your end of the deal. And to know and to be loved by our Creator, there is no greater joy than that. So we ask all these things in your name. Amen.